You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 22nd of September, 2021. I'm hoping this recording sounds okay. I have a new system that's been causing me nothing but trouble. I'm hoping there's been some sound issues in the past. I want to, hopefully, gotten rid of some of those. I make poor Sven Longshanks work very, very hard in cleaning some of this stuff up as far as background noise and everything else, and that's entirely my fault. I always want to thank him for the absolute selfless work that he does and doesn't, you know, he needs money, but doesn't ask for it. The hours he puts in is absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. Anyway, speaking of extraordinary, I want to deal with someone today, someone who I've been reading for many years. He is possibly the best known and well-read nationalist and royalist historian in Russia today. He's been around for a very long time. He graduated the college in 1972. And in 1995, he created the Russian Civilization Institute. He put out the dictionary, this massive dictionary, Holy Rus, and then four volumes of the Great Encyclopedia of the Russian People. And it's, again, a tremendous, piece of work. Unfortunately, nothing, as far as I know, exists in English. This is an ongoing problem. Places like Arctos have put out some great translations. I don't know of him in particular, but people like Alexander Dugin. And there's too few of those. There is this huge crop of first-rate nationalist intellectuals and Orthodox nationalist intellectuals in Russia that are very popular there, but are unknown even amongst specialists in America. So now he runs the Institute for the History of Russian Civilization. And he specializes in 20th century Russian history, which of course is, you know, you could live 50 lifetimes and not come close to even the beginnings of scratching the surface of what's going on, which is a problem of history in general. It's very, for young students, it's overwhelming. Like it used to be for me to go to a hard copy library and see stacks and stacks. I mean, you couldn't shoot through them. And you have to go through it all. You have to read it. You have to take notes on it. You have to master it. And, you know, that's why even in a very specialized, picky area of history, you have no choice. And this is a problem for people who want to make historical claims without having that background. You realize that everything, all these ridiculous claims, claims that people make because they're lazy. I debated someone a few months ago who made, you know, one of these claims that everyone kind of makes because they don't really know any better. The claim that the Russian winter stopped the Third Reich in Operation Barbarossa. In fact, I mentioned it in a show I did on that for the anniversary. And of course, it's false. Most of the victories of the Soviets were in warm weather. I think only one or two of the what Stalin called the 10 victories, or 10 great blows on Germany. I think only two had anything to do with snow. But it's one of these things that people just throw out there. You know, my favorite always is Russia's dependent on oil. No one bothers to look at the figures. It's something that everyone says, and it's easy. And it's typical laziness. Well, someone who's a specialist in the field, a serious specialist in the field, is going to be able to take that apart. But even specialists aren't doing that anymore, usually out of fear. But this is an ongoing problem. So going over the literature of 20th century Russian history is a task that very few can handle. I wrote, of course, I have a book, The Soviet Experiment, published by the Barnes Review, dealing with just the first few decades of the USSR. And you have to draw the line somewhere. There's just so much material, so overwhelming, you could take any sentence and expand it into another book. And that's the task that Oleg Platonov has set for himself. And he's uncovered things that no one else has. And with the level of detail and this meticulous research that he's put out is really second to none as of right now. I do disagree with his belief that Stalin was this nationalist. As of a few years ago, he maintained that belief. I have several, in fact, my book takes issue with that theory. I have broadcasts on that theory, kind of all over the place. That's been a big issue of mine. He was absolutely nothing of the kind. Stalin, Trotsky, and Lenin were identical in terms of ideology and really policy. The only difference among them was the resources at their disposal. So, but it's a very common mistake among Russian nationalists that Stalin is one of theirs. It just isn't true. So we start off. I mean, there's a million different places to start here. You know, in the USSR, of course, the Jewish issue was one of his central ones. And, you know, by the time of the revolution, it's something like 3 million total in the USSR. And yet, of the Revolutionary Party in Moscow alone, you had roughly half of the membership. You had a huge spike in Jewish incomes and wealth in that particular period. And this is something that he specifically uncovered that hadn't been done before. That you see this fairly small coterie of Jewish elites who suddenly explode in terms of their wealth, precisely in this chaotic era. That really by 1935, you had this, you would sense that this is now the new promised land. We talked about the Lubizhdan failure and why that was so significant. But really, one of the many reasons it failed was that the entire Soviet Union was seen as the promised land. I'm going to be on the radio tomorrow I'm dealing with this several places, in fact, on the concept of New Khazaria, the idea that the Khazar Empire is being reborn and called that in Ukraine after the coup of 2014. But back to the era we're talking about here. Things are always worse than you think they are. You see collectivization, for example, as a group of people who have absolutely no connection to the land, heavily Jewish, that forcibly destroy the peasant commune, which actually was a legitimate socialist institution, but a religious and idealistic one, and force them into collectives. Remember, a collective and a community are opposites. The only thing they have in common is that they're a bunch of people. A community is natural. Community's been around for a long time. They have a lot in common. They have language in the broad sense of the term in common. They have an ethnos. They see one another. There's really no strangers in that sense. Community is like a family. The concept develops from the family. A collective is something along the lines of a bunch of people staying in the same hotel. They have no connection, but they're just in the same place. The collective farm was really had one purpose. It was to extract as much grain and labor as humanly possible for the sake of building the industrial empire that Stalin and the West wanted to see. But by 1928, you had a massive increase in non-Jewish poverty. About 50% were way below the poverty line established at the time. We're talking about peasants as well as workers. About 33% had absolutely no reserves. They couldn't, what we call paycheck to paycheck. And as the 20s wore on, housing was about 3 to 4 or less square meters, or cubic meters, a person, the way that they figured it at the time. But collectivization and the idea of the kulak essentially piggyback on each other. The only thing that mattered in the kulak attack is that they had surplus grain, surplus food. The West had constantly been feeding them aid and assistance consistently under the Wilson administration and afterwards, and American capital was heavily investing in it. And Platonov is no stranger to that either. But the idea of the kulak, again, something that Platonov put out that hasn't been dealt with before. Usually, you read an American historian, and they'll refer to the term meaning fist. And it gets translated, or it gets defined two different ways. Either fist, meaning to punch someone, to hurt someone, or, like is more common, that they're tight-fisted. They're misers. And because they're misers, they need to forcibly give up their wealth and their grain. So the Stalinists and the Western press claimed they were destroying the wealthy, they wanted equality. Of course, nothing absolutely couldn't be farther from the truth. A kulak is anyone who might possibly oppose the regime and who had any surplus grain. Again, run by people who had no idea what farming even was. The truth, though, is that the kulak can refer to other things. One less common translation is the mill wheel, referring to some kind of slave labor. And not too far away from that, the idea of a blockhead. But beyond that, so either way, however, the three different ways, it still blames the victim here. But the notion of the word in Platonov's mind, it also implies a movement from cyclical sense of self and society to the linear. Capitalism and communism have, or 90% of what they in common, they're very similar. And one of those very important similarities is the sense of a linear development of history. You have very specific periods based on economic, based on capital and how it's distributed, and the ideologies that are built on that. That wasn't the case in agrarian or traditional societies at all. To the extent that the Soviets were being fed by outsiders, the best land was being confiscated, and production collapsed. Lenin and Zinoviev. And their exact phrase was, they called for ruthless terror to steal whatever surplus grain and seed was available. And that was in 1922. They also were very explicit that overwork is a weapon. This is part of what the collective farm really was. Overwork is not just a way to eliminate resistance, but to break the spirit. It used to be that the church calendar, the seasons, governed and had this tremendous balance. And it was, compared to Americans, a relatively happy life because they were in these natural cycles. But the creation of fear, the creation of this linear, capital works no matter what the temperature is out. And the overwork was done to break them, to create abulia. And the Gulag system, of course, at the same time is being put together. Yagoda, Berman, Rappaport, Frankel, everyone blatantly Jewish names. None of these are Russian in the slightest. But even, going back to what we've dealt with on this show, in the 16th century, southern Russia, you had a firm under the Polish Empire. Jewish elite had a massive grasp on Russian economics in the southern part of the country, Ukraine. Even going back to Kazaria, where, the monarch, they had a double executive. The people who can elect it, almost like a college of cardinals, had to be Jewish. And of course, that found itself, after the destruction of Kazaria many years later, in the Judaizer heresy, which also we've dealt with on this show many times. And the concept of the Third Rome, which is a foundational idea, is the assumption that Jewish banking and usury had long taken over the West. England, Amsterdam, this is, as time went on, even the Turkish Empire became, and Poland, at the same time, became this purely, financially speaking, a Jewish endeavor. Therefore, Russia was alone. And that, in his mind, in my mind too, helped create the Russian mentality. The destruction of Kazaria, long before then, was absolutely essential to building the Russian mind. This is where the Jewish mind also develops. This war, this contempt for the Third Rome, or any Rome, it's in the Talmud. And as we all know, the murder of Tsar Nicholas had references to this scrawled on the walls. I have a book out on that topic. Many of you know what I'm talking about. But the number of merchants, the essentially some form of usurer, the Jewish percentage in St. Petersburg in 1870 was about 6%. 1896, you're pushing 20%, and not too long after that, in the early 20th century, you are between 50 and 60%. In the process of building this elite cadre in the capital, they then set about destroying the noble class. Now, I've had my problems with this. I've discussed the perversion of the nobility. And people forget that Jews owned tens of millions of acres of Russian land, despite all the myths that say that they weren't allowed to. They most certainly did and could. But this completely goes against what the economy was, what the economy was meant to be. The idea of labor in the Russian tradition had always been creativity. In fact, words for labor, work, creativity, same thing. The industrial democracy, to the extent that industry was going to function at all, that it had to be based on a communal idea. And because of that, I should say as a result of that, the capital exists because of labor. In fact, everything exists because of labor. Labor implies cooperation. It implies a sense of unity and purpose. There is a version of the labor theory of value in the Russian, even the peasant mind at the time. It's not to say that the natural world is worthless before labor is applied to it, but that as far as social significance is concerned, labor is how we relate to one another. The only way that anything is created comes from productive labor. The opposite of that is speculation. It's money that comes into existence without productive work. And it comes through manipulation, deceit. You know, Hermes in Greek mythology is not just the god of you know, deceit and trickery, but also of commerce. This is not an accident. The central core is self-government. It is a matter of corporate control, in corporate in the sense of communal. And, you know, this is where, you know, this is where wealth derives. And it can only be considered legitimate when it derives from what the Russians would call the artel, or the labor union that, you know, actually owned the capital that they worked on. And this is what was destroyed at the revolution, not just the Kerensky revolution, as well as the other, October and February. So, wealth is a moral category. Now, how does this work out in real terms? When this is the core ideology, in a very broad sense, when the state, or I should say the crown, is the guarantor of this, it means a tremendous level of stability. Platonov deals with a lot of the mythology that the Western world, even without meaning any kind of destructive purpose, coming from the British, even prior to the Crimean War, even the reign of Ivan IV, have put out to delegitimize any Russian influence in the East or in the South. But Russian wages, from the 11th to the 20th century, remained at least equal to the Western world. There was no relative poverty. 1647, when the law codes were being researched, your master in a guild made about 57 kopecks a day, 38 for apprentices, and for ultimately it came down for people who were better off, 145 rubles a year. Doesn't actually work out mathematically, but when you talk about averages over a long period of time, it's impressive given the cost of living. And you know, 1600, the average peasant holding was roughly 7 acres, which he says is the exact same for 1917. Even serfs, the lowest serfs in 1800, had 3 to 4 acres. But you go to Tula's 2.4, Olenets is 7, it depends on the region, but it's an impressive property ownership here. You know, in 1767, for example, UK was able to, on average, 6 kilograms of wheat per day. That was 10 and 11 in Russia. In terms of payment, in terms of production, they're in parallel. It was Russia was more productive, and it was more rational in terms of its organization because it was purely communal. And this is, in the British case, as the feudal system gave way to capitalism and the empire and mass export. This is why there's a difference in both production and pay. This is what they could expect. This is what they were able to live on. And you have plenty of foreign travelers who agree with me. In the 18th century, the average wage in Russia was twice that of France. And that's industrial wages, wages that can be monetized. People forget, and you know, I've been a critic of the urban factory system as it developed in Russia and elsewhere. they had assigned labor, meaning these were serfs that were taken from the land and sent to the factory, which is not exactly a promotion. However, after the Petrine era, urban factories were forced to offer very high wages to get peasants off the land to work for them. And industrial wages, again, this depends on the region, but 1728, 60 rubles a year. You know, 145 was the upper reach, of the distribution. 70 average may have been 60 rubles a year. 1860, the carpenter maybe 116 rubles. Skilled labor 135, and this remained relatively stable. And foreign travelers made it clear that factory labor was no worse off than anywhere else, and that they did have the highest wages in Europe. And, you know, the 1917 steel workers were roughly about 169 rubles a year. Now, cost of living. Cost of living remained stable. I can give you an income, but that has nothing to do with anything. That could be a lot, that could be a little. 29 rubles a year was the average for housing. 42, roughly, for clothing. And 58 rubles a year for food. And what makes it significant, of course, is that it's very easy for the average laborers to turn a profit here, meaning they had reserves that the Soviet Union eventually destroyed. Food at this time was at least three times more expensive in the U.S. than it was in Russia. Food was always extremely cheap. But the artel worker, or the unionized worker, where everyone owned the means of production. So this wasn't a capitalist enterprise at all. The artel unionized system, the 19th century, was able to command five times the wealth than the average Soviet worker. Soviet wages and Platonov's estimation were about 39% of the gross domestic product, which was the lowest in the world. The entire concept of Marxism is supposed to be that workers, at least at an early stage, have to be paid relative to the value that they produce. The whole concept of surplus value, in a very simple way, is at the root of this system. Worker produces, say, $100 worth of value, and the capitalist sells it for a profit, but doesn't get paid that much. Profit comes out of labor. Again, very simple understanding. It gets more complicated than that. But in the Soviet Union, this was vehemently repressed. 39% of GDP, meaning the wealth produced in the country, the value produced, only 39% of that went to wages. No one was even close to that globally. The entire purpose of Marxism didn't exist anymore. That was never the purpose to begin with. Two-thirds of the product of the average worker was taken by the state. So they may have shifted the exploiter, but they destroyed the motive to work. They destroyed industry, destroys any of the natural artistry and true skill. And it pulled the worker from the commune. And with the artel destroyed, the commune destroyed, there was nothing left but the naked, skillless proletarian. The average worker, both in the farm, especially in the cities, did very well. The cost of living was low. Cost of living was much higher in the U.S., for example. And you had travelers from Paris saying that the factory workers are better off here. And not only are they getting paid more, but the cost of living is lower. That's what happens when usury isn't at the basis of everything, that everything doesn't have interest attached to it. But even as far back, Platonov's life, the Code of Yaroslav, one of the early law codes of Kiev, loans, the whole notion of usury, as old as sin itself, a loan has to derive from goodwill. it isn't automatically for the purpose of making a profit without work. The creditor is paid by the profits of the industry. That's the difference. So someone loans money, you then become a partner, and you get paid only if the enterprise does well. That is not the case in a system of usury. The money is the only thing that multiplies, not the capital. If the enterprise goes belly up, you still owe the money. That was not the case in the Middle Ages. Well, not the case in the Middle Ages anywhere. But as I said, the artel system, the labor union, so to speak, starting from this era, was the total, complete ownership of capital by labor. And by the 19th century, these wages were continuously increasing. There was no comparison. Industrial workers in Britain or eastern seaboard of the U.S. and Russia in the cities, there's no comparison. They did better, they were better off, and the cost of living was lower. The Soviets come in, and most of their product is taken, far worse than anything in the capitalist regime. Wealth, in other words, and this is, you know, the rejection of usury, wealth doesn't exist for its own sake. In the West, that's always been the case. Wealth is the measure of a man. We still say that. He's worth $1 million. The very act of speaking in those terms comes from the banking system. So not only then the Soviet era was all this ended, but the calendar was destroyed. The calendar was rewritten. Days off no longer existed. The cyclical natural order, which of course is also connected to the church cycle as well, is replaced by the purely linear system. Revolutionary states always remake the calendar. Everything from North Korea, the French state, even Peter the Great radically changed the calendar. Apparently the church didn't have a problem with that at the time. At least the synod certainly didn't. The Soviet calendar had 360 days. At the end of the year, there were five holidays. This was modeled on the Egyptian calendar at the time of the construction of the pyramids. You had, the way that it was structured, you had 72 five-day weeks. And it was created with the Egyptian antecedent, Zelkind and Spintsevich, two Jewish bureaucrats who put this calendar together, or were in charge of the committee that remade the calendar entirely. And in the process, as Tolstoy said, this is a cleansing of Russian culture. Cleansing meaning that the Christian mind, not just in terms of liturgy, clergy, but in how it affects every aspect of life. There is no such thing as Russian culture outside of Orthodoxy. There isn't a bit of cloth or food that doesn't have an Orthodox connection. So if you're going to cleanse the country of this, then the entire the day-to-day life has to be completely remade. That was the point of war, of constant fighting, of mass casualties, of constant confusion, of collectivization, the destruction of everything old and comfortable, constant fear of persecution, laws that are never followed, completely arbitrary actions, a press that makes up stories as it sees fit, and of course, the complete change in the calendar, the invention of this Egyptian style. Anyway, there's no days off here. They experimented with six-day weeks. They tried to eliminate Sunday altogether for obvious reasons. And the only incomes in this era that went up were Jewish incomes. And Platonov was the only one who was able to put this together and explain how this worked statistically. and it's not an easy thing to do. And given the nature of Soviet records, it was a painstaking task. So to summarize here, there is no secondary. The economy was more rationally organized than in the Western world. Again, we're speaking in very general terms here. Wages were higher, while the cost of living was lower. The Christian calendar maintained its existence all the way up until the Soviet era, which meant that the cycle of the seasons, rest, religious holidays, dominated the landscape, quite literally, in fact. Work was a means to an end. In the capitalist system, the Soviet system, work was a means to enrich the party. And in their minds, it was a way to increase their domination nature and their godlike status. We spoke about that elsewhere. The manipulation of the calendar, the notion of a whole totalitarian system, is based on the destruction of the morals of the population. And this is what war does. This is what war, fashion ideology, the co-option of elites, the manipulation of the press, what war, I mean, revolutions require warfare. Because warfare destroys all moral foundations. In the Peloponnesian War, Thucydides, and was really the first one to explain this. War will destroy how people view themselves. Life is cheap. Deception takes over from intellect. This is when a revolutionary movement, like the communists or the liberals in France, Britain, this is how they come into existence. And of course, the left in the U.S. after the Civil War, and then again after the Vietnam War, and what they were able to do, and of course now COVID, with the Great Reset. This kind of warfare, or some form of extreme dislocation, and COVID certainly counts, where everything shifts, everything is shifted. The state takes over the economy. The old ways of doing things are completely null and void. This is, and the moral the morals of the population fall away for this reason. The constant chaos. Eventually, they're desperate for a natural state of rest and repose. They never quite get it. This constant stress leads them to support whatever it is at the moment that they think will solve the problem. No, peace is something that the traditional royal economy thrived on. Chaos and warfare is what the Soviet economy and revolutionary economies constantly require. These revolutionary governments, from whether it be the foundation of Israel, the Kahal system, the French Revolutionary, the Soviets, the Chinese, wherever it goes, they have one justifying statement. And Pol Pot was very much like this in Cambodia. Who, you know, of course, is educated in France. And that is, we're fulfilling history. We are creating justice on earth. And because of that, our enemies, who are frightened of us, surround us. They've infiltrated our homes. There are agents everywhere. Therefore, all bets are off. The state can do whatever it wants. This is the case in Cuba all the time. You had people snitching on relatives and friends at the block level. You see it now with the COVID thing. And, you know, the white supremacist, the various snitch lines that the so-called Biden administration has set up. The snitch lines, telltale lines for websites for COVID. This is, every revolutionary movement has this. We're surrounded by enemies. And we need to maintain a constant state of revolutionary vigilance. This phrase comes up over and over again. It's constant stress. And as a psychological factor, it breaks down the psyche. It completely alters how they look at the world. And that nothing remains the same. Nothing is stable. You know, passions get fulfilled and then they go away again. and then they come back. Nothing is stable. Their passions are the only thing that matters anymore. There is no truth anymore except which is controlled by the party, and that's always changing. There is no place to stand. And if there's no moral place to stand to make a statement, then you can't complain when the regime bears down on you. There's always a revolutionary party. There's always a sense of fulfilling historical destiny. But, as any good historian knows, making believe, creating this fantasy view of history, is something essential. Peter the Great took over and created the revolutionary state in his floating city of Petersburg. He ordered that the old local histories be burnt. How much was lost? You know, the stuff I've done on Peter the Great, we all know. The history has been destroyed. It's been butchered. He replaced it with his own. The idea that Russia was this backward hellhole up until he came over and brought Western European masonry into to enlighten the population. The rise of Prometheus. All this, you know, Masonic imagery. And it wasn't true. It didn't exist. But given the mass destruction, and Peter was constantly at war, the population went down in the country. The economy was shifting, monetization, destruction of the monasteries. The church was destroyed. An entire diocese, the whole 18th century were depopulated. And good bishops, of course, were broken on the wheel. I've dealt with that, St. Arsene Matyevich, one of my favorite saints of the era, the new martyr to the Petrine yoke. As you know, he should be called. And you have a whole, you know, St. Paul, you have many others at the time, tortured to death by the Petrine and movement of Byron and this Masonic intellectual revolution. Rewriting history was essential. And Western Masonic cults became the center. They were secret, but they weren't secret. And as always, bringing in foreigners who ran his clique, his little party, constantly had to deal with the fact that at least they were told that the ignorant peasants and the reactionaries and the old believers are right at the gate, ready to destroy you unless you stick with me. Every revolutionary movement has this as a core ideal. The ideology even doesn't make any difference, except that our revolution threatens the world. The U.S. was doing this since 9/11. We all know what that story is. So not only do you have the constant chaos of war and revolution, you have the chaos in even the most fundamental workings of the mind, and rewriting history, telling these people that they don't have a history, burning and destroying the old records. And they all did it. I mean, the Soviets did it. It was normal procedure. Peter the Great, though, even before the French Revolution, made it a direct command to destroy this. And very little in Western historical scholarship has dealt with this at all. World War I, for example, not only in the Bolshevik mentality later on, the leftist and Menshevik mentality in the West, is a constant source of humiliation for the Russians. And none of it's true. The mythology, which is being promoted by people of all historical background, is that Russia was a failing state with an absolute monarch, which they never define, a massive bureaucracy, medieval in its organization, minimal industry, no passable roads, couldn't build an industrial war machine, led to a situation where as the war began, massive fighting, massive armies took place, the greatest of all time in terms of numbers and casualties. Russia couldn't keep up. The supply problems were so bad, as the myth goes, soldiers were borrowing rifles. It's a ridiculous story. It never happened. The opposite, of course, as is usually the case with these things. This is some of the lazy, as I mentioned early on, the lazy sloganeering that people engage in. You know, we use it with a wave of the hand, like they know something. The opposite is usually always true in this case. Battle of Gumbinnen, for example. 74,000 Germans against 64,000 Russians. The Russian counterattack brought the German forces to a panic. The 17th Corps of the German forces in the east were defeated, and 6,000 POWs were taken. Germany and Austria-Hungary, again, were defeated at the Battle of Galicia. And this is when the Germans, of course, realized in World War I that they were completely overstretched. People also forget that in France, for example, their military discipline was breaking down. They had a 5% desertion rate in the last year and a half of the war. Now, supply shortage is one of my favorites. This is something that Tan of many others have taken aim at for a very long time. No one expected this massive amount of men to be mobilized. It never happened before. Nothing ever came close to millions, some tens of millions of men on the field. This has not happened before. No one was prepared for this. No economy could function here. But right away, the Russian industrial system made 800,000 rifles. 3-inch guns in that first few years. 8-time increase. The howitzers. From 1916 in both cases. Middle of 15 to the beginning of 16 in the howitzer case. 60% increase in development of these weapons. The projectiles, the shells. They were making far more than the Western world was. And we know this because von Hindenburg actually made the statement. And people were noticing, of course, that the French military was falling apart in terms of desertion, that even as the war came to a close, the Russian army did not disintegrate. They maintained a great and tremendous discipline. Russian production did not lag behind. Of course, there is a problem of the sheer size of the country, but Russia had the largest army in World War I, roughly 10 million men, which is almost inconceivable to military commanders prior to them. In the process, they won key victories, as I mentioned, and destroyed the Austro-Hungarian Empire, knocking them out of the war entirely. His commander Knox and the British forces made it clear that Russia was well supplied. That was never something that came, except for propaganda, usually much later on. And the Bolsheviks much later developed this theory that it was such a bad economic system that there's no chance of winning the war. Russia was humiliated. And of course, none of that was true. The propaganda, the leaflets that the Reds were dropping for infantrymen, that their wives were being raped at home, that the war was over, the Tsar said to disband, and all this kind of thing. And yet, Hindenburg makes it clear that it's the military discipline to a great degree was maintained far better than the French. The Germans failed to take Romania. This is a key source of oil. But like in the Crimean War, we did a huge article in the Barnes Review on this, and at least one broadcast on. Russia was always alone, fighting the entire planet. World War One. I think I was using this as an example. This laundry list of myths that World War One has sprouted. Russian Empire was at war with Germany, of course. To a great extent, Romania. Austria-Hungary, Turkey, and Bulgaria. And this was a huge number of men. This was a huge number of industrial potential and development. And of course, by Romania, I'm referring to those parts under the Austrian state. Romania had a very strange connection, being neutral for a good chunk of the war. And then being under the in the Allied system, then of course the defeat by Bulgaria changed all that, the Treaty of Bucharest. And so the Romanian case was a very strange one. But these were the nations, at least under the Austria-Hungarian system, which were aimed at Russia for better or for worse. And these states, the Balkans and close to it, were all brought against Russia, as well as, don't forget, the Turkic tribes in the south, in the Crimean world, and using these tribes to constantly harass not only Russian forces, but the Serbian forces as well. And this went back to the Balkan Wars and all the rest. So this is just the very beginning. But when you talk about Russian supply problems, you're talking about an army of 10 million men in a huge country that was not expecting this. No one was expecting this. And yet they still did not have the supply problem. The first year of the war, everyone had supply problems. But there was no such thing as this nonsensical sharing rifles, as if any commander would acquiesce to something like that. But, you know, even near the end of the war, it was very clear that Germany was in a lot of trouble in these. They were shifting, you know, by the end of the war, they had shifted another 2 million men to the east. The state of Skoropadzi, which I have sung the praises of over the years, remember too, was also allied with the Germans, although much later in the war. So the point, of course, is that Russia, not only given those handicaps, is fighting pretty much the entire world. And having Turkey as an ally is not exactly, you know, interesting. And they were knocked out of the war and humiliated very quickly. Turkey, of course, was a very different story from Russia. Russia had every bit the industrial might that Germany had at the time. It was simply less concentrated. The discovery of oil meant that now Romania wasn't really the only source, and Russia could be completely self-sufficient. This is one of the reasons that the British, while technically on the Russian side, needed the monarchy to be overthrown and have the Rothschilds, which they eventually did, move in and buy up the Baku wells. As so many have said, this war destroyed what would have been the Russian century. You had massive population increases. You had an economy based to a great extent on equality. You had mass peasant land ownership. You had very high rates of morale. You didn't have a lot of alienation like you had in oligarchical states. You had a relatively popular monarchy. You did have a small bureaucracy. You had the artel system. The ability not just to earn a good salary with a low cost of living and zero inflation, but to do so on your own terms. An artel didn't have a boss, so to speak, like you would in the factory system. And ultimately, at the end of World War I, Russia suffered roughly 6 million casualties. Her enemies, Russia inflicted about 4.8 million. So that's pretty much a draw as far as that's concerned. And those statistics, we talked about those statistics too in the Crimean War. The attacks from the Crimea to World War I, you had the same propaganda. This backwards state, mired in the Middle Ages, incapable of fielding a modern force. And of course, the propaganda was taken literally. Same thing for the Russo-Japanese War. It was taken literally, becomes now standard history that very few people in the English-speaking world can challenge. But in Russia, of course, it isn't taken seriously because you have people like Platonov who are relatively speaking, mainstream figures. Now, one other issue I'm going to be bringing up fairly soon. I can only give a fairly brief synopsis, is the idea of new Khazarian. I've dealt with this on the radio several times. I've mentioned it in passing in some of my writings, but there is a Jewish movement to rebuild the Khazar Empire in parts of Ukraine. In February of 2014, with the direct funding of these Jewish oligarchs in the U.S., and you had at least 400 fighters of, trained soldiers and advisors from the IDF, the Israeli forces and special force, were brought to Ukraine by the chief rabbi of Kiev. This is part and parcel of the coup d'etat against the Ukrainian state there. And the that coup, and this is made in the Russian press, but not here, the rabbis of Kiev ordered the local Jews to celebrate the bloody massacre that took place then as another Purim. That's very explicit. And the Jewish press there in 2014, when the pro-Russian or more or less pro-Russian government was overthrown, the Israeli Ukraine was being, or the new Khazaria was being established. And the refrain was common. Before the Crimea became an ethnic Russian possession, it was potentially a Jewish state, which is one of the central ideas of this new Khazaria. On March 17th of that year, you had terrorists trying to seize Syria. They offered Israel transfer the Golan Heights in exchange for military assistance. That Israel is ready to temporarily withdraw the Jewish settlers from those fortified military areas in the Golan Heights to Ukraine. So at this very same time, Ukraine, captured by the junta there, agreed to accept these settlers. And the Times of Israel made it very clear. You have a shift of manpower from the Golan Heights to Ukraine in the process of building a new Khazaria. And the line from the Jewish press, or the Times of Israel, taking into account historical ties in exchange for the much-needed weapons in the confrontation with Russia. This is nothing new here. One thing is new is the rebuilding of the Khazar Empire. Not so much the Zionist Israeli state anymore, but something that's far more secretive. You have a recent interview with Yevgeny Gilbo, the president of the International Academy of Humanitarian Technologies in the U.S. The former Ukraine, Russians are being deliberately pitted against each other, clearing space for new entities, ethnic cleansing. That former Ukraine should be, brought down to 8 million people, which, by the way, was Trotsky's idea, the general to kill non-Jews, the hands of non-Jews. But the Israeli Special Forces, the battalion Elia, arrived in the Donbass by June of 2014. But these are the very same people who were involved in the cleansing of Palestinian territory. This was a Khazar Special Force. This is considered a historical land of the Jews. And there seems to be a shift in Jewish mentality here. I'm going to get into this in more detail as time goes on. But the coup in 2014 was extremely significant in the mind of the rabbinate in Kiev. That this is something that had a secret core to it. That is not well understood in the West right now. As I said before, Kissinger a long time ago said by 2022 Israel won't exist anymore. Warfare, population, there is a search for places that this Jewish elite can then form their society. And Zhirinovsky, who the so-called Russian nationalist, who in fact is a Jew, whose real name is Edelman, has confirmed all of it. It is, Khazari is materializing again. It's on the Dnieper. And because the Russians are heavily divided in Ukraine, the Khazars are able to take over with minimal resistance, except, of course, for the movements of New Russia. And you have these Jews who infiltrated the Ukrainian elite, even in the early 90s, very similar to the Judaizers of the West in medieval Russia. We all know that of the 15 wealthiest so-called Ukrainians, 10 are Khazar, and the remaining 5 are very, very closely associated with them. And they are organized as a caliph with a Kagan. The Kagans of Kravchuk and Kuchma, the formation of the power, the Khazar Beks, as they call the oligarchs, took place. Yushchenko, who was the beginning of the establishment institutionally of their power. And the uprising against the Khazars, exactly what happened in Eastern Russia, or sorry, Eastern Ukraine with the Republic of Donetsk. And you have this almost divine power, which you see. The director for the Center for Jewish Studies, Leon Feinberg, in the Kiev Molia Academy of War Places, Shimon Berman, Mark Ostromolowski, Likachev, Bernard Henry Levy, Moshe Reuven Asma, Pashinsky. All of these were connected very closely to the 2014 overthrow of the Ukrainian state. The notion being that Khazaria was founded on that day. And Odessa, the largest synagogue in the world, exists there. The money is pouring in because Israel is not supposed to last much longer in this new Khazaria mentality. So that's just the beginning here. This is a very, very broad, very simplistic outline here. But new Khazaria is developing, and I'll be talking about that very shortly. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.